Welcome to Top M&A Entrepreneurs. Today, my guest is Jordan Hammonds, who started an HVAC company in Canada and took it from $1 million to $14 million with two acquisitions. We're going to see how he does that. Also, he talks about what really makes a competitive advantage, because one of his first entrepreneurial ventures, he had to shut down, declare bankruptcy. So we're going to see how he recovered from that and moved on to building a $14 million HVAC company. All right, now we're going to try something completely new for top M&A entrepreneurs. If you can tell me one of his two acquisitions he bought from a husband and wife team, what was the multiple he paid for them? If you put that in the comment section, I'm going to give you one of my courses for free. That's up to $500 value. And the second question is, what is Jordan's gross margin for genuine comfort? The first person to put these answers into the comment section below, I'm going to give you one of my courses for free. All right, let's get on to the show. Well, welcome to the show, Jordan. How you doing?
I'm doing amazing, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being here. I wanted to talk to you about genuine comfort, what you learned from your journey. Now, you started Genuine Comfort, which is an HVAC company, 2010, right?
I did, yeah. Started in 2011, and that came on the heels of my first business that I started in a retail sector, and that went bust pretty quickly. But thankfully, I learned some lessons that I could apply to the Genuine Comfort, which was actually back then called HC Air Conditioning. We rebranded it. Yeah. It's 2019, we rebranded.
Yeah, so let's talk about those lessons. What did you learn from, and I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, it was definitely a bankruptcy. So what did you learn from that? I mean, kind of rewind a little bit how it started, you got the idea and how big you got it, and then where did it start falling apart? And you go, oh my God, I got to pull a plug.
Yeah, day one, I knew it was done. You know, I just wanted to get in the game. I was 22. Thought I had a God-given desire to be an entrepreneur. And, I just jumped in. I didn't really do the post-secondary route. I did a very short business program. And so it was my MBA of hard knocks. And it was a retail concept, very low barrier to entry. The competition was fierce. The online competition was just ramping up. So literally, as I'm setting up the whole concept, I'm being blocked out from suppliers by my competition, who was telling these suppliers, key suppliers, hey, if you open this guy up, like we're not going to carry you anymore. He's like, I would do this. My competition was trying to open up. So, I saw even before we opened, it was before day one, probably, that was now some issues. And, it took about a year to kind of, before I finally pulled the plug and said, that's enough. And it was a tough year, but really, your first question was, what did I learn? I learned what having an actual competitive advantage looks like in reality and not just on paper. You really need to write down a business plan. This is what we're going to do, and this is why the customer is going to choose us instead of the competition. Are you actually able to execute on that in reality is what matters. And, yeah. And I wasn't. I didn't have any definable competitive advantage. So going forward, I took that lesson to heart, and I knew whatever it was I had to do, I had to clearly be able to articulate to the market and have them actually give me feedback that they would be willing to pay for that competitive advantage, over one of my competitors.
Yeah. How, when you filed the bankruptcy, I mean, how deep did that go? Was that a business bankruptcy and personal too? Or you just everybody that watches the show, like, wow, how far did you have to come from? Was it way down in the sandpit or just like, I wrote that off and restarted?
Yeah. I mean, I had PG on everything, right? So it was personal. Personal bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like, what, 150,000 to 200,000 liabilities? And, being a guy in my early 20s, I probably could have clawed my way out of that without going the bankruptcy route. I choose to go that route. I don't really have any regrets about it. I might have thought about it more if I could go back and do it over in my early 20s, thought about how I could claw out of that without going the bankruptcy route. really the biggest impact was just on the credit, right? The liability going forward on the credit. But it really didn't impair me from starting up the next business, having that bankruptcy. I ended up getting a line of credit when that bankruptcy was only 4 years old on my credit. And, I might get lucky in a couple of situations, but it didn't really impair me that much.
Yeah. Maybe they saw something in you. You just kept getting up at bat. So this new idea that you came out with, Genuine Comfort, how did you create this, the competitive advantage? I mean, what was it?
Yeah, competitive advantage wasn't rocket science. It was product availability. That's all it was. I got to start in this space because it is a niche of a niche. And, I was working for a company at the time, distributed appliances, and a little kind of add-on product that they had to selling appliances to apartment buildings, so property management companies was our main avatar, was these air conditioner products to go through the wall into apartment buildings across Canada. It's not a big market at all. It's like, I'm talking tiny. It's like a 2 million, maybe 2.5 million market across Canada. So, I just saw that they were dabbling in it. They didn't care about it. They ran out of air conditioners when they ran out. They didn't order another container from China because they didn't want to sit on them throughout the winter. And I saw very clearly, like, customers, when it comes to August and it's still hot outside, I think that's all their tenants. Sorry, we don't have an air conditioner for you. The tenant's sweating in their apartment. Like, it's causing problems for them and their business. And we weren't doing anything to solve that need. So, I just kind of ran with it. I made as many connections as I could, figured out how to build half a parachute before I jumped, and then jumped and took, half of the customers with me my first year. And then the other half that were wondering to see if I was still going to be around the year after, they ended up coming with me the year after that. And that was really how we got started. We had stayed there in just that market, but that was the genesis of HC air conditioning back in 2011.
And you use that line of credit to go buy inventory to do that?
Yeah, I didn't have a line of credit at first. So I use something called factoring, as I'm sure people are aware. Factoring is the most expensive financing you can get. But I did see the game. The other financing that I got, and there's stories around this, but I had cash flow issues my first year, even with the factoring. And one of my suppliers from China, $1 billion Chinese brand, they forgot to bill me for a couple containers worth of product for about 6 months. And, we're talking $150,000 USD, $125,000 maybe. Like, when you're getting started and you just have $1 million in sales, that's a big deal to float you for that long. And so I got floated by some reduced bills. Ended up coming, I ended up paying them, but I got floated with that by that situation for about 6 months. And that really, I would have been able to figure it out, I'm sure, but it was nice to have that cash flow float for that long. And then by my second year,
take as long as possible to pay your vendors.
And don't chase them, right? Especially early on. Yeah. Chase them. It's different when you get further along and you want it for reporting purposes to be able to get your books tight. But at that time, I was like, don't send that bill. And then by my second year, I was able to convince a credit union to give me a line of credit, small one, and obviously increased the interest rate over the traditional FIs.
And what kind of size of the business was it the second year?
$1 million, about $1 million top line, and SD at that time, we've been doing about 250 SD.
Yeah. And you're running this all by yourself? Do you have any partners or anything?
No, need a bookkeeper. Yeah, need a bookkeeper on all the sales. I mean, it's a very simple business at that point. Very seasonal.
You just get product from China and find these property managers that need in-window units and then just supply those. And did you do the installation too, or did they have their on-service guys do those?
Yeah, no install needed. So we're strictly a distribution company. We don't have any trucks on the road. We don't do any out-on-the-road service. We do, tech service and over the phone.
Yeah.
So it's a really simple model. It's a distribution model. And, I was doing it all with the bookkeeper. There's a warehouse component to it, but that's all 3PLs. There's a procurement component, but that is extremely simple back then. And, then you're just selling and collecting the money.
And these relationships with the China suppliers, did you actually ever go to China and meet them, say, hey, I want to see who I'm buying from? And
Yeah, I was going over there in 2017. I have a product manager, procurement manager, does that trip annually in China. But yeah, I went over there once with Guangzhou in 2017, and this is when we were trying to get deeper into our supply chain and really get to kind of the end of the line with China in terms of like the most effective form of supply. In China, it gets confusing. There's a lot of people that are agents that appear like they're actually the factory, but they're not. And you can kind of get muddled in all of it. So I went over there and we kind of got to the heart of, you know, who is the actual factory, and let's start a relationship with them.
Yeah. And buying more units at a better price.
We've driven down our costs consistently over the years, and doing the acquisitions, which I'm sure we'll get into, that really helped us just get the knowledge of how to drive those down even further.
Yeah. So where were you, what kind of revenue were you at when you started these, thinking about buying these other companies? And
2017, 2018 is when I started thinking about it. I started dabbling with other acquisitions because I was stupid. I started getting outside of my circle of competence. No entrepreneur does that, right? That's not.
Yeah. Narcissists will punish you. Yes. Yeah.
So, after I learned my lesson a little bit there, I started focusing on my own space, and we were about 4 million top line, back in 17, 18, and doing.
Were you about the same bottom line? About 25%?
15% on the bottom, around there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was how many people figure out for a single lifestyle business. I wasn't complaining for sure. We were just kind of a mom and pop shop. It was me and a handful of people at this time, a couple of sales reps, ARAD clerk. It was about five of us.
How did you pay those sales reps? That's curious. Was it a lot of commission, some base commission?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a standard in Canada that's different than the United States. Like, I don't know if that's different.
It's all different industries. So we paid back then, the one main rep I had, I paid a very small base. I'm remembering correctly, about 25 grand a year base. And then the rest commission based on gross margin percentage. Yeah. So commission not based on the top line, but based off the middle line for based on gross margin.
Yeah.
And they did well. He probably made, he was making over six figures for sure.
Well, so what did the make the bell ring on these sales? Like, how did he become really successful?
Yeah, relationships. It was opening up a new territory is when I hired my first rep. So the province next to us in Saskatchewan. So we started expanding in 2013. That's when I hired him. And I just started opening up, I don't know if your Canadian geography, but Saskatchewan and Saskatoon, Regina, and then going into Alberta and BC. And it's going to the associations, it's going to the trade shows. It's easy to find all our target customers. I'm their only property management companies. We weren't into hotels yet. So it's limited to how many there are. There's maybe 150 across Western Canada. And so it's finding out who's the decision maker, getting in front of them. There's no marketing component. It was just all...
Just phone calls and creating relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just planting those seeds and watering them over time. And you have to be the right kind of person to be able to do that. But thankfully, I kind of got lucky with that first hire.
Is he still with the business?
No. He kind of bumped up against the level. The people you start with, usually you don't end with, right? So, when we were kind of doing our next revolution and getting into professionalizing the business more, he didn't want to make that jump. So that's when we parted ways.
Yeah. I haven't been any of the other, I used to be live in Plattsburgh, which is right below, Montreal, Quebec, and then the other side where my wife's from in the Washington and that side. So yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful country. Where did this idea come about acquiring these other competitors? How did that transpire?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, I kind of got into the, ETA, SMB space and just, I got really interested when I started to have a little bit of cash I could play with. I was like, what do I do with this money? Because we were just growing organically at that point. So I had excess cash. I was like, but in real estate. And then I started hearing about this micro private equity. and hired a guru, you know, one of these guys back in 2017, and did his coaching program. And didn't have, you know, wasn't a good experience. I'll leave it at that. I already mentioned it wasn't a good experience, but I ended up at this conference in Vegas in 2017. And, you know, these conferences, you hear a ton of stuff. Hopefully you take one nugget away that you actually apply.
Just one.
That's it. That's all I needed to make it worth it. So the one nugget I got was a guy that exited for 8 figures. And he said, the best thing I ever did, and the reason I was able to produce all this enterprise value, was when I started in the business, I reached out to all my competitors and I started having those awkward conversations, and we built relationships over time. And when they were ready to pull the plug for whatever life circumstance came along, right? Death, divorce, disability, you know, whatever, partner goes away, they called him. And he was like, we ended up acquiring, not because we were like seeking to acquire, but just because we had those relationships. And it just dawned on me, John, at that time, I was already trying to acquire these little websites that I had no idea how to make money at. I lost money.
It occurred to me at the time,
why the heck did I do this M&A thing, which I love so much and so interested in my own space that I already know everything about?
Yeah. Right? How many competitors did you have throughout Canada?
Yeah, 4 main ones and then some tertiary ones.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what a rollout was. No, I had no idea. I heard people use the term. I had no idea what it was. And then when I told somebody this, they're like, oh, you mean like a rollout? Yeah, exactly. Like
yes, rollout. Yes. Yeah. I'm exactly not trying to be naive, but I am. It's an okay.
Yeah. Well, that's how the idea got planted. And when I got home from that conference in Vegas, I literally just picked up the phone and I just started calling my competitors and having awkward conversations.
Yeah. How did that conversation go? Hey, by the way, my name is Jordan, and I'm your competitor, by the way, and just interested if you ever want to talk about selling.
Didn't go there right away, but it did sell like the part. And what it started out with was, you know, hey, we don't compete directly against each other. We did a little bit for sure. And it was saying, hey, like any information I have that I can share that can help you, right? We're trying to maybe we can help each other with making sure we don't run into some of these hurdles. And some of that is kind of fluff and it doesn't mean anything. And it's just to get them on the phone.
First, you're starting to kind of as colleagues and friends, right? You'd like, hey, let me help you with best practice. Here's my best practice. You know, like.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the guy on the other end of the phone and you kind of both know, like, that's not really, like, it's just kind of fluffy. But
yeah.
The thing that I learned that actually held weight and that actually made a difference was I was just transparent about a lot of stuff. And I could have led it first. Like, not like giving away anything proprietary, but like, really, there is nothing proprietary in our business. So I would just tell them, like, hey, this is kind of what we're doing revenue-wise. This is what we're finding on the cost side. This is what we're finding with suppliers right now. Like, I would just lead with all that. And
were they providing the same suppliers? You had to go to China or different people completely? Because I've done some China business and like there's so many people that build the same thing.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's definitely some of that. So some of my competitors were different suppliers, different supply chain. Some were getting supplied by the same people, just put a different name on it. So it was both. But the point being, I led with that vulnerability first. And then over time, you got the thing in conversation, right? It takes 20. And you stay in touch, shooting a text once in a while, shooting an email, just planting seeds. Like a guy that I know down in the U.S. in Tennessee that's acquired over 50 businesses says, my business is just planting seeds and watering them. And some of these seeds, they don't come to fruition for 15 years, right? Sometimes you get lucky and you get one that comes to fruition in 6 months. That was our first deal. It was...
Yeah, 6 months from first call to the
less
starting. Yeah.
Five from first call to closed and like possession was 5 months. Yeah. And so that's not talking, right? Not even close. So I look at it as that, right? I'm continually planting seeds, building relationships with people in the space. You know, and if I start another search in a different industry, I'll be doing the same thing. And you're fully expecting that lots of them, you know, they will take a long time to mature.
Yeah. And how did that guy, what was one of the reasons why he wanted to sell?
Lockdowns in Canada.
Oh.
So he was.
They were pretty strict. Canada.
Non-strict. We were a communist country for two and a half years. And
Trudeau was just going with his bureaucrats told him to do. Yeah.
I know who you thought they were still a communist country, but we won't start talking politics.
We'll go there. Yeah.
So you know they were a mom and pop shop. They were making $500K on the bottom line, but they were working 60 hours a week. Both of them, him and his wife, did a couple people working part-time for them. Just that old-school mentality that if they want to grow and they want to make more money, they got to work more hours. So they were just getting burnt out. And then the lockdowns come, and the hotel industry gets shut down, and they're like, oh, shoot.
Nobody's buying. How much did that affect their business? Like, what did it look like?
Martin got cut.
Half.
Yeah, so at that time, he calls me up, and he's like, okay, we're ready to get evaluation done. We're ready to chat seriously. And we made that one happen quickly.
How did you feel about that? You don't want to overpay based upon, previous years, but you don't want to be a vulture, waiting them for them to die.
Yeah. I mean, we were the only ones at the table.
Yeah.
So the business is worth what the market determines is worth. I'm not interested in squeezing dimes and nickels out of people. I don't say pennies. We don't have pennies anymore. I'm not interested in that. I'm you probably didn't know that. We don't have pennies in Canada anymore. You told me to look at your face.
No, I didn't know that. Yeah,
they scrapped them. But the market will determine what it's worth. So, we were the only ones at the table and we got a good deal because we were the only ones at the table. And we took a risk because we were buying this thing in the midst of the government saying you're not allowed to have your hotel open, which is all our target customer.
And no runway on when they would open up. Just nothing. Yeah.
No, it was complete guesswork in terms of what was going to happen to our economy, right? And how long we were going to be able to keep everything closed.
Yeah.
So, there was risk in us for sure, but we bought at a valuation that mitigated some of that risk for sure.
Yeah. What was the valuation?
We paid 1x earnings.
Yes. Sounds great.
And then we got a 25% take back as well.
Take back meaning seller financing?
Seller
now. Okay. 25 year? So he just kind of gets mailbox money.
Sure. 25%.
Oh, 25%.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very nice deal. And, but how did you pay for that? Did he ask for, the 1x right up front or do overtime, some kind of terms?
Yeah, so 75% was that close, 75% of value. We financed most of that through cash flow, through retained earnings. We took out a little fixed loan for the amount. We did 1x earnings and plus we paid inventory as well, I should clarify. So 1x earnings plus inventory.
Did he have too much inventory or?
No. They were actually the other way because they knew they were exiting, so they were careful not to over.
Just whatever they needed. They just had just in kind of time inventory.
They were running lean. And they didn't have a long supply chain like we do. We have a 5 months. We have a 5 month lead time. They were ordering domestically, so it was a lot easier for them to keep their inventory tighter. Because it was just like, hey, if we need stuff, we're only a three week lead time away. So they make those decisions quickly.
How did you find their accounting and their finances? Was it clean, ugly, what?
Yeah, clean. They were using Sage. They were on top of the books. I had a CFO at the time. He's now on my my fraction CFO. And he did a great job with two acquisitions. I couldn't have done the integration just myself without him. And he did an awesome job on the books side of the details. And we ran into a couple small issues here and there, but just like the regular stuff that you bump up against in
deals. Yeah. By the way, Sage is definitely a level up from QuickBooks. So that tells you something about the financial integrity.
Yeah. No, so yeah. We had zero issues there. The integrations on both of them were were fairly smooth, except for the people component on one. The first thing we did was a little messy.
How many people did he have?
Oh, this was our second deal, the one we're talking about, and he had zero people. It was
he's at zero people,
and then him and his wife each putting in 60, 70 hours a week. And they'd actually let go of both their part-time people during the lockdowns. So it was literally just him and his wife. So there was no people transition with that second
deal. Oh, interesting.
What did that do to your business? In even though the business cut in half, what did that do to your business? Like, and then revenue, and then the customer list. Basically, you're buying a customer list too.
Yeah, pretty much at that point. That's the asset. Yeah, it's when this year. I mean, it was a bit of a bump. I think their biggest year they did 5 million. So you know, the initial bump was 2 to 2.5 million, and then as the market started to come back in late 2022, kind of mid to late 2022. We bought the business in April of 21. So then you really start to see it in the subsequent years as the market comes back, as you know, the integration happens. You know, it took us to renewal 14 this year. So between our initial
$14 million this year?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
In our first, you know, our just ourselves getting to 2020, we were at about $4 million. And then we tacked on about another 5 million from the first acquisition, and then this last one's about another 5 million. So
The second one was the mom and pop where the two were putting in 60 hours. What was the first one?
So the first one was very interesting. First one was a PE, micro PE owned, basically orphan business.
That they cast off, didn't want, or come to you, or what was it?
They were just done. So they made, it was a bit of a nightmare from the beginning, I think. I won't get into too many details, but they bought it, and it wasn't what they thought they got. And then they made two bad executive hires that blew up the payroll. Ill-fated U.S. expansion, which many a Canadian company has done. And
that's always the dream, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
How do we tap into that golden goose?
Exactly. And it's there's few small businesses that I've seen make work. So they were just done. It was not profitable, way too many people, and they just had no outlook of how they get back to the black. And they in these companies, they have like a business is askew to them, right? It's a product to them.
Yeah. It's just like, is it making money for us? Is it moving the needle or is it not? If it's not, you gotta dislodge it. Yeah.
And it's taking money out of the system. So for every year they have to run this unprofitable business, it's not only we're losing that money, but we're losing the opportunity cost of what that capital could do for us in our system to buy another business that's growing at a gross rate of 25%.
There's a threshold, like a 30% IRR or 35. It's not. It's out. Yeah.
No, and then this was well below that threshold. Yeah. It was an interesting situation. I hadn't talked to them before. And I just had this gut feeling one day, like, hey, it's time to talk to these guys. And from the day that I called, we had an LOI signed 2 weeks later.
Was it the owner that you talked to get to this PE-owned company, or was it somebody employee?
CEO kicked us up to the team backers. Yeah, and then we're dealing with the managing director and the operating the guy who's operating the Portco.
Yeah.
We got an LOI signed real quick. You know, it was an amazing first deal to do because doing a deal with a PE company is like no emotion, just all business. You know, they don't want to deal with your son. It's just a deal for them. They do it every day. And these guys were awesome to deal with. I still keep in touch with one of them. Me and the owner of the PE company have exchanged some messages and it was a fit for both of us. They dumped it. You know, we got it. We could make something that had no value for them. We could turn it into a lot of value for us. And it worked all both ways.
Yeah. And it was losing money. Was it selling the same products, same different manufacturer or same manufacturer?
Yeah. This ended up being the same manufacturer. We thought we were kind of dealing with an agent of this manufacturer. So by acquiring this company, we got talents. We got a couple really talented people. We got direct to the manufacturer through them, and then we got this customer list.
Yeah.
So it was like 1 + 1 = 10 for us in this intron.
Yeah. So couple of years later, that was a definitely a good acquisition.
That $5 million in revenue, when it was fully realized and we were out of this government-induced economy, government-constricted economy, it produced $1 million in EBITDA from that one.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Plus, you know, one of the most knowledgeable person in our space, product-wise, in the whole country.
You brought on staff.
Yeah. We got this individual, massive asset in our team.
Where does that person sit? What kind of role does COO or what?
No, they're more of a project leader than a people leader. So that was actually a big learning. We actually completely screwed that up when we first acquired it. We put this individual who was their CEO. I kind of just assumed, oh, if this person's running this company, you know, they're qualified to be our COO. And it was not the right seat for them. It was crash and burn. It really showed me the expectations at one company or can be drastically different at a different company, even if they're similar size. And, you know, it took a couple of years to get him into the right seat, to get him where he's effective. But now he's absolutely a massive asset for a team. Get him into the right seat, do a good job, really to manage him.
So you're doing about this two acquisitions later, you're doing about $14 million. You're still at the same kind of profit percentage?
Yeah, we're the stuck up here right now. So we're doing a big ERP implementation. We got some extra payroll because we're trying to really get an organic growth engine going. A little bit lower this year, but you know, where we're at, we should be at 20% on the bottom would be.
That's pretty good for that's dang good for a distributor.
Yeah, typical, like best in class is usually 10%.
I mean, I was like 5% of distribution.
5% normal? Yeah, 5% normal, 10% and doing amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what are you doing to get to this 20%? What is it? Low overhead, great prices on inventory. What is it?
Yeah, it's a couple things. We've done a lot of good R&D work on our side with these kind of niche products that we've been able to drastically lower our COGS on. But also produce a great unit and so kind of our cash cow product. You know, we'd be 60 to 65 links gross margin on this, you know, kind of cash cow product that we have.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we had to put a couple $100K into it, a few trips to China. It took some years to get there, but it's
so you're doing R&D and taking it to them to design versus just buying off the shelf.
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of have this partnership with our manufacturer now, which came through this gentleman we were talking about who we were able to hire from this acquisition. Without him, we wouldn't have any idea how to do any of this stuff. Now we're able to kind of work hand in glove with the manufacturer to help them R&D. And they have the tooling and everything, but we actually own the product. We own the rights to the product.
Yeah. That's like is it your brand? You create a whole different brand. Yeah.
So that's why we rebranded in 2018, 2019. We created our brand, which I mean, it's really nothing when you're just slapping your name on a product that comes off the assembly line like everybody else's does.
Yeah. What Whirlpool and all those Maytag do. It's just like it's the same product, just like a different brand on there.
Yeah, they're based on Palladia, which is that big Chinese company that forgot that they only for 6 months, you know, $35 billion company. We've been able to actually R&D a couple of our own products that need to be able to rights to, and that's where a lot of the person comes from.
So it's kind of interesting because you were able to see this. You were doing what everybody was requesting, and all of a sudden you saw this niche. So what is this really lucrative niche? Is it the unit over the window, or is it still in the window? Or
under the window, in hotel rooms and senior living and apartments.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's a small market, and there is a barrier of entry. Like you're going to need some capital to be able to compete with us now because there's. Now you're going to be buying containers from China and, you know, it's not like it'd be extremely hard for somebody to start up, but, you know, there's a barrier to entry, but it's still small enough where the big guys aren't saying, hey, like, let's focus here. Stay off the radar of people with, you know, some big financial resources.
Yeah. How big is the market for you? Like, you said you're investing in some R&D and some ERP. Is there some other markets you're going after and acquisitions you're looking at?
Yeah, so we're still trying to roll up the rest of the Canadian market. So Canada's 30 to 35 million. We got 14 of that. So we're working on.
Are you allowed to do that in Canada? Because we have this rules down here that you can't be a monopoly. You can't buy up all the distributors.
Like for like a 35 million market, but don't you think that
somebody might file a lawsuit? Nope. Yeah, somebody might file a lawsuit. If you buy up five of them and there's one less and you see differences, you can't compete, they'll file a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
Different year for sure. There's nobody that would even to operate or might.
Interesting.
And what's that level at? You know, like what is a monopoly? We're just a lot less litigious up here, right? Too much. Big difference.
Well, you're in private equity EBITDA numbers now. Are you getting calls from somebody wanting to buy you and help you out?
Yeah. To grow? Yeah, I get it. We've made a couple of lists of Canada's fastest growing companies the last couple of years. So there's people that just scan those lists.
That'll do it.
I've called once in a while, but nothing. Yeah, I'm not looking at anything, until there's so much value left on the table for us.
Yeah.
For me, it doesn't make sense. I might take some chips off the table at a certain point to try to diversify a little bit. Just grab on the right minority partner, but not looking at selling the majority anytime soon, unless some stupid kind of number comes across my desk.
Yeah. How are you making those decisions? Like what opportunities to go for? Do you have a board of directors now, or is it just still Jordan Hammond?
Yeah, I have a board of advisors. So we have a leadership team, which is relatively new and we're developing. I'm in the process of hiring my COO. I'm in the CEO visionary seat right now. I'm not sure if you're familiar with EOS, but
we've run that. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're a big EOS company. Just got back from the conference a week and a half ago. Been running on EOS for 6 years. And so finally, hiring my COO, slash integrator. And been running a pretty big process the last few months. And we're almost there. So in other words, we got talent at the table. And then I recruited the board of advisors, just three, team of three board of advisors. So it's not a... No, it's not board of directors, the board of advisors.
Board advisors. What do they look like? I mean, we kind of look at somebody that's already been there, done that, bigger than us.
One guy's got extensive experience in distribution. So he's been COO of companies, $300 million companies. He was a PE kind of hired gun to go in. So he knows distribution in and out. Another guy is a guy that's been in distribution in the telecom space. He's had three exits, part of my network I know really well. And then the other guy is my former CFO, who is now a fractionate CFO for me. So he has all the context on the business, really smart guy from the analytics and finance and accounting side. And so, somebody gave me really good advice when I was starting to think about a board of advisors. They said, seek a board of advisors that actually wants to get context on your business or already has it. If it's just doing a quarterly board meeting for the sake of one and you're just reporting out and they're just looking at, what's transpired, there's no value there. That's to be a board that actually seeks to understand the business and the context and then seeks to add value through your network, capital, advice.
Well, your bottom line, if you're bringing in a guy in distribution, you say, well, I'm at 25% margin now. How do I buy products, cost of goods better, get them shipped here faster, everything costs less there, I put more to the bottom line.
Yeah, they speak the language, they've already been there. So, we're only 6 months into this, so we're just learning kind of how to create this effective relationship between me and the board. But I think it's going to be well worth the return, well worth the investment that we're putting into it.
Yeah. And so let me just ask you a couple of questions, like the best decisions you made, worst decisions you made on this. Like, don't do this. Like, somebody listen to this, go, don't do this or do this.
Related specifically to what?
Just growing this business and starting growing these acquisitions. Like, I mean, one of the eggs is like, don't go outside your core competencies. That's a great decision.
Yeah, I won't repeat that again, but that's 100%. They'll chase the shiny coins. Investing earlier in a leadership team, like if Like, I would have done it earlier if I didn't redo it. Once I saw the trajectory of where the business is going, I think I waited a little bit too long to hire that leadership team. And
what were you seeing to make that decision? Were you coming up against like a flood of decisions you had to make and you weren't making them fast enough, or what?
I mean, the team is growing and need to be able to expand the leadership to be able to lead and manage these people effectively to be able to add value to the business, or else not like just get burned out. And I don't want to be the type of entrepreneur that works 60 hours a week. I don't. I work 25 to 30 hours a week. I'm going to keep it that way. So for me, it was like, how do I go find talent, and how do I like do that recruiting and hiring talent? And I'm not saying I learned everything there is to know about that, but I have met a lot better in the last few years. And just being, truly seeing that investment in the leadership team as an investment and not a cost. Like, as stupid as it sounds, it's like, it's going to cost, a lot to have a fully functioning leadership team that's leading each department. Our leadership team is going to be around $700,000-$800,000 a year when we have our COO on board.
That 14 million top line, 50% or 40% cost goods.
It's an investment that will pretty through not only now, but to get us to our BHAG, which is to be a $50 million company by 2030.
So that sounds like it's going to require a number of acquisitions. Do you have an imperative over the next, 7 years, 2030?
Yeah, we don't need to cut lab, and we can't get there just organically.
No way. So yeah.
I'm always working on, like I said, planting and watering those seeds. You never know when they're going to come to fruition, but, I specifically know the targets, and I'm always working on identifying other great fit acquisitions. So there's going to come a time where they loosen up, something happens, and then I can be there for that situation, and hopefully we can work on a deal that makes sense.
I was just curious, how is the numbers that you looked at when you were running $1 million company changed to the numbers you're looking at today? Like, what are your CEO and your managers like? What numbers do you give you that you know you could tweak a little bit? Hey, we got to focus on that, or what do we need to do?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers just become bigger. I mean, our KPIs have gotten tighter as well. Inventory efficiency.
Tighter, less number of KPIs or what?
No, more. I mean, more. Which is an issue too. Like, and that's something you're always fighting against as a business grows. And we're not perfect. The complexity tends to just spread organically and spread by nature. And really, you can simplify and keep it to those tight metrics, which our ERP is really going to help with. Right now, we're just running too many different spreadsheets and systems, and it gets confusing. So the ERP is going to help with that, central dashboards, keeping everybody tight. But the biggest thing for us has been inventory efficiency. So in a distribution business, your working capital is everything. And your working capital, like, it's asset light. Our working capital is AR and it's inventory. And the AR, we're super tight on. Our weighted average days to pay, we're green. If that's under 30, we're usually rocking at 25, 26, which is amazing for weighted average days to pay. Our inventory efficiency has sucked, and that's a function of our demand planning and a function of our sales, obviously, the demand planning and our procurement system. And that's the area where we've just been brutal. Like, we're running at 2 turns right now, trailing 12.
And just 2 turns, and you should be, your new inventory board of advisors said it should be what?
Well, they did not tell me that. We kind of got the context. About 4.5 would be where we should be.
Yeah.
But it's hard when you have a 5-month procurement cycle. Like, that's a long time to predict out. It's simplifying, and it's getting the communication flowing really easily between revenue and procurement. So that's a focus for us in terms of efficiency. And then the other big one would be revenue per employee. We're running pretty low there in terms of efficiency. We should get over $1 million top line per employee. And we're running at like
$1 million per employee.
Yeah. Best practice. We're running about $550,000 and that's, that's kind of cultural changes that need to be made. It's efficiencies with the ERP system that need to be made. It's training, developing, growing people, foreign into people, personal development.
Yeah, well, you get more turns to 4.5 to 5, you'll get there.
Yeah. So we're certainly not a perfect business. We got tons of opportunities and internally and externally. It's the question is always which one you focus on now, right? Because you can't do it.
Right. Well, fantastic, Jordan. Fantastic story. I really appreciate you spending time on the show. What last question? What kind of businesses are you looking for to acquire?
Going outside of our space, I'm always looking at acquiring, within our roll up. But I'm looking at launching another search, hopefully in Q4. Will kind of be my new platform once my COO is ramped up and I'm hopefully down to less hours per week. And I haven't determined exactly what niche I'm going into. I'll kind of tell you my thesis. My thesis is to do the exact same thing that I've done in this industry in terms of identify that niche and go deep on that niche. So I plan on starting pretty wide with a broker, a broker outreach. And, getting 20 to 30 LOIs in order to determine where actually I want to focus and then deep diving on that focus. Because
not this niche, a different niche or?
Yeah. Well, this is kind of my next, when I get to the next platform. So okay, we'll be ready to grow in this, but, the COO is really going to be executing on the business plan. We got a very experienced COO coming in and hopefully it works out. But maybe just to leave with one thing, one of my biggest takeaways from all this was these two acquisitions that we did that added a ton of value, a ton of our enterprise value. Any financial buyer that would look at me would have walked away instantly.
Yeah. There was
zero financial value for them in either one of these acquisitions.
Yeah. If you would have taken that, the second one with the two husband and wife running all the revenue and working 60 hours, I doubt that would have got approved from SBA down here in the United States.
No, I know. It was still a total risk. Owner-centric. And then the other one was losing a lot of money. So
yeah, that wouldn't have got any money.
Right? So it just showed me that being a strategic acquirer and knowing the space well offers a lot of advantages versus being industry agnostic.
It's the first one. I got to tell you, if you build on the first one, it comes a lot easier.
Yeah, 100%.
Jordan, thanks for being on the show.
John, appreciate it. It's fun.
All right, let me stop.